Essie Adujan is a Canadian author whose works reflect her own global perspective. Her second novel, Half Blood Blues, was shortlisted for the 2011 Man Booker Prize and features a mixed-race jazz musician abducted in Nazi Germany. Her latest novel, Washington Black, is another historical novel that ranges across continents. And it's inspired by a true story, as I found out when I spoke to her via Skype from her home in British Columbia. Essie Adujan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
For readers who haven't yet read Washington Black, could you give us a little bit of background to the story?
So Washington Black is a novel set in the 1830s, and it's about an 11-year-old field slave called Washington Black, who was born on a plantation in the Caribbean, and he's known no other life. It's he has been a slave his entire life. He has rarely known a kindness from anyone, and so he's quite shocked to find himself taken to live in the quarters of his new master's brother, who's a man called Christopher or Titch Wilde. Washington is horrified by the prospect of going to live with this man, but he soon finds that Titch is completely different from every other white man that he's ever known. Titch is a gentleman scientist, so he's a naturalist, he's an inventor, he's an illustrator, but he's also an abolitionist, and it's really through his taking Wash out of his situation in the fields that Washington comes to have a greater sense of himself as a fully realized human being. And he understands that he too has gifts to offer the world.
And you were inspired to write the story by a real life story. I believe it's based in part on the longest running legal case in British history.
Yeah, so it's the Tichborne claimant trials. They started in the 1860s and ran all throughout then and all throughout the 1870s, and were indeed the longest running series of criminal trials in the British courts until like the 1980s. And essentially what happened was the scion of a very wealthy family from the south of England was shipwrecked at sea. He was a bit of a dandy and had been making a pleasure tour and ended up being shipwrecked off the top of, I think it was Argentina. But in any case, he had a very, very doting mother, and she just was so devastated and refused to believe that he had died. It just didn't seem natural to her. So she consulted a clairvoyant who assured her that her son, whose name was Roger Tichborne, was alive and well and living his life in a distant country. So what she did was put notices in newspapers and get a response back from a place called Wagga. Essentially, the gist of what the note was mother, my life is a butcher in a small Australian town, but I'm ready to come back now and take up my mantle, the head of the estates, and assume my inheritance. And she was utterly delighted, but she was utterly convinced that it was him. But just in case it wasn't, she thought that she would dispatch somebody to go out and make the identification. And just by chance, one of the household servants, who this was a man who'd worked at the Tichborne estate for 40 years, he had retired recently to Sydney, Australia, so it was very convenient for her to consult him and ask him to go see if it was indeed Roger living in Wagga. And this man's name was Andrew Bogle, and he was an ex-slave who had been stolen off of a plantation in the Caribbean by Sir Edward Tichborne, a member of the Tichborne household, who had been doing a bit of work, I guess, at a friend's plantation and had seen this young man and decided to take him away and steal him away. And Bogle lived out most of his life in England as a servant for the family and had a whole new life. And so when I was approaching the claimant trials, I really wanted to depict them through Bogle's eyes. But as I sat down to write them, I realized that I was kind of less interested in all of the many, many, many details of the trial that just went on for decades. And I was much more interested in the psychology of somebody like Bogle, who had been, you know, born and raised in very brutal circumstances and would have felt like everything in his life was preordained and that he would likely die on the plantation. So to be removed from that very suddenly and taken to a place that was so radically different from everything he had known, I was interested in how that would manifest itself, in his psyche and what that would do to him and what kind of trauma he was still carrying with him forward into these new years of his life.
And like your previous two novels, it's very much a book about aftermath, about rebuilding one's life after terrible events and trying to find happiness and fulfillment in a world that is set against you.
Exactly. And trying to kind of reestablish, your own identity, just trying to find your foothold in the world and to create, really, Washington has to recreate his sense of self, which has been so, trampled upon for his early years. He really has to figure out who he is as a person and, accept that he too has rights in the world. He really has to develop a sense of agency and taking control of his life and accepting that certain things are within his grasp to change, but then there are things that will forever lay outside of his grasp, and that being physically free is, his physical freedom maybe doesn't open him up to every other type of freedom that he imagined that it would.
And that experiment that Washington constructs with his making of his own new life is mirrored in the scientific experiments that are going on around him, initially with his master Titch, who is fascinated by flight, and then with an exploration of marine biology. You're clearly also fascinated by early scientific discovery during the 19th century.
Yes, very. It was something where I discovered I was fascinated by it almost by accident. It was, I was feeling my way through the novel, trying to really get a sense of Washington's character, what his interests would be, what he would be leaning towards. And then I just started reading about, historical science and naturalism and the first environmentalists and discovering how they went about classifying specimens. And I realized I had a very deep interest in this, and it really took over the second half of the novel, and I was it was a real pleasure to get to write about that.
That pleasure really comes through, and whilst you dig deep into, both the early flight and marine biology, you never layer it on in trowelfuls. Where do you stop with research and start putting your fingers through the keyboard?
Yeah, I'm somebody who I start every book with research, because you need something to help you enter the text. And because I tend to write historical novels, it does require some background in certain things. So for Washington Black, that was reading about plantation life as it manifested itself specifically in the Caribbean, and even more specifically in Barbados. So reading deeply about that, it wasn't so much delving into the science at the very outset, but I also research as I'm writing, and this is something that helps keep my mind in the book and helps keep me interested, because I'm continually discovering new facts and able to put them into the book, or to go back and use them when I'm revising. So I'm researching from before I write until probably just before I end the book, and it's just been my process, and it's been very helpful.
It's quite a political book, and I know that you describe yourself as a Black writer who needs to confront the world as a Black person, but you managed to keep bitterness from the anger that you feel at what Washington undergoes and what your other protagonists have undergone. How do you do that? Because some pretty awful things happen in all three of your books, actually.
Yeah. I'm sure that the characters do feel, you know, a deep bitterness over the injustices that have been perpetrated upon them. But, you know, bitterness is one of the stages, one of the many stages of grief that people go through after they've been through something traumatic. So I think it's, I don't know about bitterness, but certainly a kind of resignation does permeate the books. It's definitely there, and the anger. But these are novels about people who are confronting their pasts, but also trying to construct their futures and look towards what life could be in the coming years. And so perhaps that's what's maybe taking the edge off a bit.
I did wonder also whether the fact that science is there to be destructively tested, science only moves forward once you've disproved something, also shows a hope that any wrong belief will eventually be proved wrong and something better will come from it.
Yeah, I love that reading of it. I think that's great. But, and I think that's true in some cases, that we have, you know, science is the discarding of one theory for another. It's working through things. And maybe sometimes, though, those off theories don't get discarded. And that's something that we have to definitely to look at and to try and be on guard about. But yeah, there is a feeling that at some point, something that seems, you know, like it's wrong, it will eventually be discounted. That's the hope.
I know that many people with sight loss would love to have as strong a champion for our marginalised community as you provide. Do you know of any really strong blind writers, either over in Canada or that you've met in your travels?
I know of one, and he's a poet. I believe he did a memoir about his blindness. I think his name is Ryan Knighton. He did a memoir about going blind at a, you know, he's very slowly going blind, but he's very young. And it started when he was a very young man, I believe in his 20s. And, you know, that book was you know, extremely eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people who don't really understand what it's like. So yeah, that was a very important book that came out a few years ago here.
Well, hopefully, like you, he will inspire others to take up their pen and write. You must be delighted that your books have been made accessible to people who are print disabled. Do you take an interest in the audiobook narrators who are chosen?
You know, until I did Washington Black, I was never really consulted about the actors and the whole process. But with this last book, it was very interesting. I was let into the room, so to speak. So I spoke with the actor and the producer, and the actor tried out different voices to, you know, we were really trying to get the right accent. And it was a wonderful process. And I think Dion Graham did a brilliant job of the audiobook. It's a miracle. He just sounds exactly right.
And you, of course, are married to another author, aren't you? Does that create a little bit of competition in the house?
You know, it's been good. I'm married to the poet and novelist Stephen Price. He's an amazing writer. He's got such discipline that he really, you know, he puts me to shame, and he's a real example for me. But it's been really great in that he and I edit each other's work. And so he's been through most drafts of my novels. I think he gets a bit tired near the end, but, you know, he'll go through them quite rigorously. And I can honestly say that the books, you know, they wouldn't look as they do without his hand on them. So I'm really appreciative and grateful to live with another writer.
So this is the second time that you've been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Did you get the same frisson of excitement when you got the result?
I did, absolutely. It's, it's quite incredible. I would never have thought, that this could happen twice and for a follow-up book. And it's so exciting. I'm so excited and thrilled and honored. And yeah, it's always exciting. I don't know. I think you'd have to be pretty jaded not to be excited.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Essie Adudjian, and I look forward to reading plenty more of your fine novels in the future.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.